tonight is the Church of the 80s, a women's agenda. And I'm Sister Maria Gustinio. I'm a sociologist from Boston. I was a little bit afraid at the first sitting tonight that people would think this was an agenda only for women. That's not what the title means. I'm making the bold thesis that the problems of the 80s are more specifically an agenda that women historically have been dealing with. And that is one of the reasons why the problems are so hard to solve. Because to solve the problems, one has to be in the position to be able to make the decisions. And the problem of the structure of our society is that not many women are in those positions where the serious decisions are made. In many cases, that's a historical problem that we are not responsible for. We are not responsible for creating it, but as the community of adults in the church today, we are responsible to do something about it. Now, this is not an easy thesis for me to demonstrate. And I would like to have you come in on it at any time when you either want to make a position or state a clarification or even challenge what I'm saying. I said today and this morning and last night, because I'm a sociologist, I usually have some data to demonstrate what I'm saying. But data is interpreted in different ways by different people. So for those of you who are new, I just want to point to what the substantial data is. My thesis is that because the world has so radically changed since 1950, in no way can we use any structural solution that we used prior to that time to deal effectively with the problems that face us now. And this little chart demonstrates what that thesis is. And if a few of you are interested, I Xerox it on a little sheet, and I can make some, I think, here at the Xerox if you want it. But this is a picture of the population change since the year 8000 BC. Now, I'm not going to go through it in detail because I've done it already. But the point is, in the 10,000 years from 8000 BC to 2000 AD, the radical change in population size begins really in 1950. For the first 9,950 years, we were working out producing the first billion people. And there was lots of space on the face of the earth for us to spread to. In the next 100 years, we produced 2.5 billion. So that in one century, we more than doubled our population. And then in 25 years, from 1950 to 1975, we reached 4 billion people. And the projection for the year 2000 is 6 billion. The problem is that most of us, in our anxiety, felt that this number was going to go on infinitely up into the future. But if you project population from year to year, what you find is, as communities develop and develop resources so that people don't die early and do stay alive, population declines in those areas. Not because people are not interested in people, but because they have to take care of the people that stay alive. Those of you that have two or three children know how expensive it is to feed, clothe, and shelter them, to educate them, to provide medical services, and also to assure care in their own retirement. The peoples of the world who produce very large populations have high infant mortality, low life expectancy, that means they're poor, and therefore they generate people to replace the people who are dying until they develop. Now, the people who are doing that and increasing in large numbers are not the people of Oceania, North America, the Soviet Union, or Europe. They're Latin Americans, Africans, and Asians. They are the peoples of the future. Now, in a Christian perspective, we accept all the peoples that are produced as our people, as children of God, as those who belong to our community. Theoretically, or biblically, and the good news of the New Testament was that God was no longer a tribal God, for the God of one people. And we looked at the map of the world and saw if you put Africa and Europe in the center, you could see that at one time it was all one land mass. But we usually don't do that. We put the United States in the middle and we split the Soviet Union and China in half and have them on either side of us. So we can't meditate on the fact that we were at one time one world. But when we look back historically, we find that we've taken our religions oftentimes and turned them into tribal religions. That is, a religion for us and our progeny. But the our progeny, that is the children of the future, were often only the children that were closely related to us genetically. So that we developed immigration laws, for example, that excluded people who were different from us. Now, if you live in a city, any place in the United States at the present time, you know that the new peoples of the city are Africans, Latin Americans, and Asians, which is the logical people to be there, because those are the countries, if you studied your statistics that I gave out this afternoon, those are the countries that are at the present time not producing sufficient to keep their peoples alive. But we did look at this afternoon was the fact that even in the United States, where we are producing enough to keep the people alive, we're not really keeping the people alive. Because even though we are the richest nation in the world, in fact, 20% of our population only has access to 5% of our goods and services. And that's the bottom 20%. And the top 20% has access to 45%. Of our goods and services. And you say, well, it's going to get better in the future. I'll pass this little table around, and if you look at it, it goes up to 1971. But I've done the statistics for 1981, and they're just the same. The reason the lines are straight, usually in a graph, things go in interesting places, they go up there or down there, and these lines just go up and down. Because from 1947 to 1971, and now of 1981, there hasn't been any change in the United States in the distribution of resources. So having wealth in a country doesn't mean that the people of that country will share in that wealth. Something else has to happen. What I'm calling that something else is a share in a women's agenda. And for those of you that can't see this one, I'll pass it around so you can get it up close to see what the people of the future are. Now my thesis tonight is this, and it's tentative, so you have to be very alert. Don't let me get away with anything. My thesis is that in our recorded history in the Western world, and especially since we started being an industrial and developing world, we have relied on theories about production which remove us from any responsibility for health, education, and welfare of the whole community. If you think for a moment, at the present time, we purchase health, education, and welfare like any other commodity on the market. We're one of the last countries in the world to take seriously the fact that health, education, and welfare are in fact people's rights by reason of being alive. When I say that, that's a strong statement to say about the United States. Now, taking care of feeding, clothing, and sheltering people has been a women's agenda because of the division of labor in our patriarchal societies. The men have ruled and are the heads of the corporations, the government, the church, the educational system. Historically, women have been busy feeding, clothing, and sheltering the family. And that seems perfectly normal to everyone. And I'm sure to many, it still seems perfectly normal. But it could be just as normal for men and women to take care of feeding, clothing, and sheltering children, and for men and women to make decisions about the production and distribution of goods and services. My thesis is that the men haven't done a very good job. Now, I'm not condemning any man. I'm just looking at the fact that everyone in this room would say the people who make the decisions are responsible for the decisions they make. And if the people that are making the decisions are men, then it follows they are responsible for the decisions they make. It's almost impossible, I think it is impossible, from the research that I've done, for people to take responsibility for behaviors for which they are not accountable. Or in other words, for which they don't have any power. Now, I wrote an article with an embarrassing title. The title was given to me, and I was asked to be out of honor. It's published in 8 languages, so I can't take it back. The name of the article is The Pathology of the Men's Church. And what it's saying then is, what is wrong with it? Now, in the article, the thesis is that at the present time, the world is characterized by some specific overwhelming problem. One, the arms race. By dividing the world ideologically between two very large superpowers and thinking in those terms of the competition, the conflict between those powers, we have legitimated, that is, made lawful, the production of destructive weapons sufficiently lethal to destroy the whole world. We did it. We actually used our ingenuity, our science, our engineering, our capacity for corporate planning to produce this enormous overload of destructive weapons. And even today, we can still argue, I mean today, July 21st, that if they produce more, then we will have to produce more. We argue that, even though we have enough to destroy the whole world. Now, I call that a pathology. We have a need for energy. In fact, I have a splendid little document here, which you can look at carefully, of all the things we need and how we could get them. It's a 1983 publication. It goes with these data that we've been using. It deals with food, energy, minerals, and land. The actual knowledge that we have available at the present time of those needs. So the second pathology is before, and I should say, the Union of Concerned, Physicians for Social Responsibility have come together and said, if we were to use any of those materials, we are totally incapable of providing the care that would be needed for the destructions that would occur of human life. The second pathology is that we've developed nuclear energy. Now, nuclear energy is a human good. The problem is it produces enormous waste material, and we don't know how to dispose of it. Science has not invented a way. Do you know why? Because it's not productive to invent a way of getting rid of waste. It's only productive, I shouldn't say productive, profitable. It's only profitable to sell the energy, but not the waste. And because getting rid of waste is not profitable, we don't do it. So we usually leave it to women to do.
I have to ask you a question that occurs to me as far as talking about men, and that is, I tend to think a lot about just humans, and humans have done this, and to me it's kind of an interesting point to argue, you know, how much of it is men and how much of it is just humans, that humans up to this point haven't advanced very far. Maybe it is men, but
I'm presenting the thesis tonight that it is men.
Good, let's hear the thesis, then we can take her on.
Not generically speaking, because when, and the reason I'm saying that is, I asked you to look at the heads of corporations, states, churches, educational systems, health systems, to look at the decision-making group, the corporate body that comes together to make the most powerful decisions. My only thesis is a very simple one. The people who make the decisions are responsible for the decisions made, and no one else. And it just happens that the majority of those people are men. So just looking at it, counting the numbers and looking at the system, that's just the way it is. Now I'd make the further thesis that in looking just at the two pathologies we mentioned, that is the overproduction of arms, which we don't need to fulfill the function that is perceived as needed, and the production of nuclear energy before we know how to dispose of the waste. We could spend a good 25 years developing methods of eliminating the waste, and then the Union of Concerned Scientists would say, yes, that's a good thing to do, but not now. However, it's so profitable that if you take a map of all the nuclear plants in the world, they're in some of the most crowded parts of Europe, for example, and in some places in the third world where they're very, very dangerous. So we made the decisions and we went about and we did the production. And we used our science and our technology to do it. Then the third pathology, for those that came in late, we're talking about the pathologies of the male church. The third pathology is the one we've been looking at this morning and last night, and it's the most serious one of all. We've gone about this activity as if we had an unsolvable problem, a problem with no technical solution. That is, that the population was inevitably going to outdistance the food supply and the resources needed for food, clothing, and shelter, and that therefore we had to find alternatives that didn't allow the development of peoples. And what we've done this morning and yesterday last night is pore over the data, and of course I've seen you poring over these statistical charts. I have seen a few people doing that. And I gave you a little piece of data to take home so that you can really look at it. And we find out that in fact, as of 1983, that when we look at just one measure, that is the percent of calorie supply as percent of requirement, that's the one I asked you to look at today, that the world produces 109% of what's necessary to give a balanced caloric diet to every man, woman, and child in the whole world. In other words, we can keep people healthy and let 9% be overfed. That's what we produce, not what we could produce. That's what actually exists in production now. And the United States, it's 138. But when you look up and down this chart, I've checked off all of those that are under 100, which means those are where the really poor people are. And this morning, because we were looking at a sociotheology of letting go, we looked at the biblical mandate to go out and feed, clothe, and shelter the world, to announce to the poor that the land belongs to them, and to figure out a way to do it. And because that was the sin of the world, was not doing it. We looked at Luke 3, where Luke condemned the people for their sins, and then they said, what should we do? And he said, if you have two coats, give to those who have none, and if you have food, do the same. So it's very hard to think that if that's the repentance for sin, that sin isn't having two coats when others have none, and having food when others are not fed. But it said to give to those who have none. So you have to look at the map today to know who to give the food to. And then I'll pass a piece of data around the room, it'll get you eventually, in which we see that even in the United States, we have an enormous amount of wealth. Three times more wealth than any other nation per capita, in the world, absolute wealth. And yet, 20% of our people have access to only 5% of that, and another 20% to 43%. So the third pathology is, the only way we could figure out to solve that problem was to start producing food in the United States to make it balance, the balance of payment all right, so that we worried about our finance rather than about our food. Now, when women are dealing with food, clothing, and shelter in the family, they have to find a way for the food, clothing, and shelter to go around, to fit the body of people. So in a world of four and a half billion people, if we say, yes, these are our people in our Christian commitment, then our primary task becomes, how do we feed, clothe, and shelter them? Now, the solution that we had was, we can't. Therefore, we have to let some of them die. And that was the lifeboat ethic, and we looked at that this morning. But we've actually taught in the university and preached in our churches that since everyone can't stay alive, at least we can save our own. But we divide our own, even though we were Christians, as people of a certain nationality or of a certain community. And we have to say, by what right? There's nothing in our Christian tradition that says the people next door or the people in the house are more the people than the other people. In fact, Jesus was quite strong on it. He said, my mother and my brother and my sisters are out there, not in here. Some people argue he was anti-family. And what he was doing was extending to the whole human family. So that left us with what I would call an Arthur D. Little problem. Now, I'm sure way out here in Seattle, way out here in Washington State, maybe Arthur D. Little isn't as well known to you as the Boston area. This is a company that guarantees it can solve any problem. And it brings together people of all different disciplines until they can solve the problem. So when I say we have an Arthur D. Little problem, I've taken the position that Frantz Fanon took, that either we all stay alive or none of us. Now, in the male way of doing that up to now, it has been, that's not practical. It's silly for us all to die. But the women would say is, who said we're all going to die? We're all going to live. You say, well, we've never before been able to do it. And we would say, but that doesn't mean we can't do it. We've never before had a population that we knew was going to taper off around 10.5 billion. We have never before in our history known the absolute value of our resources exceeded our needs. We didn't know it until 1975. Well, some of us are saying, we don't even know it now. But the problem is, it's knowable now. If we don't know it now, our ignorance is culpable. It doesn't mean it's easy. It means we have to invent a structure to do it. But if our ethics and even our theology doesn't mandate us to do it, we are never going to do it. So let's look at that. So I'm at the second stage. I've looked at the pathologies. And what I've said is, the church has celebrated this world. Even today when we were talking, people wanted us to celebrate the existence, the work of the multinational corporations. And I have to say that even though I would like to think we could, I can't do that at the present time. Because the multinational corporations which control the resources of the world and the sovereign states that work with them to support what they're doing are only producing in a way that overproduces for one third of the world, produces a little less than need, that is, the people have less than they need, for one third, and has to let one third die. And that's not good enough when we have sufficient food and we're not going to have too many people. Now, I will say, one of the reasons we secretly affirmed the arms race is because we couldn't think of any other way of handling the people. But we don't have to do that now. All right, now, we usually pick up human problems when we're able to solve them. In the last 100 years, the Christian churches have been very active in looking at the problem that I have just outlined and coming up with some preaching and teaching and urging us to do them. So much so that some of you feel, even in this lovely village, that we press too high this agenda as ours. But the good news is that once you get rested here and you go home, you're dealing with a solvable problem, not an unsolvable one. That's good news. Now, knowing that, when the nations got together in 1948, knowing that we couldn't do it as a nation, that we had to do it as nations interrelated and developed what we call the United Nations, as distinct from the League of Nations, which blew it. We started with a charter, as every organization does, and it was called the Declaration on Human Rights. And it named a whole bunch of rights that people have. Now, a right means something that you can reach out and take, because it's yours, the right. However, it was only a declaration. We have this marvelous system in our world of stating what we feel is a truth, a wonderful truth, and saying, but it's only an ideal. Of course, we say, over and over again, we say, well, I agree with that theoretically, but practically, you can't do it. What does that mean? It makes no sense. If you agree with it theoretically, what you're saying is it can be done. Practically means, but given all the problems that exist, you can't do it now. Well, as soon as the person says that, then I always ask them, well, what are you doing towards the beginning of that? Usually it means, since you can't do anything about it now, you can go home and not do anything about it at all. All right, but however, the United Nations came out with this marvelous document about our human rights. Then they set up a commission in 1948, a commission to turn the declaration, which is only an encouragement, into law. And they started a commission to convert this into law. They called it into a covenant. But when the committee came together, the commission of people from all parts of the world who were experts, and they sat down together, as we're sitting here, to carry it out, they came to basic disagreements about which things were rights and which things were privileges. And they came to such real, deep, absolute differences, which means their definition of the situation was entirely different. They had to divide into two committees. And one group said, well, we'll work on these rights, and you work on those rights, because otherwise nothing would get done at all. So they developed two covenants, and when they got finished, it was 20 years later. It was 1968, or 67, really. And those of you that are in the World Council of Churches know that there was a meeting in Uppsala that year, and they took up this agenda as their agenda. And those of you who are Catholic, and I think that's me, we had Papa Lauren Fabrizio came out that year on the development of peoples, and the Latin American Church got together to try to convert it into some kind of specific program for the continent, because that continent was predominantly Catholic. Now, here are the two covenants. Now listen carefully, because you should recognize one and say, yes, I, as an American, agree that those are human rights. And the other one say, yes, those are really nice things, but... All right, now see if it comes out that way. A country ratifying the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights undertakes to protect its people by law against cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment. It recognizes the right of every human being to life, liberty, security, and privacy of person. The Covenant prohibits slavery, guarantees the right to a fair trial, protects persons against arbitrary arrest or detention. It recognizes freedom of thought, conscience, and religion, freedom of opinion and expression, the right of peaceful assembly and of emigration, and freedom of association. Just think your answer. Second one, a country ratifying the Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights acknowledges its responsibility to promote better living conditions for its people. It recognizes everyone's right to work, to fair wages, to social security, to an adequate standard of living, to freedom from hunger, a right to health, a right to education. It also undertakes to ensure the right of everyone to form and join trade unions. Which is ours?
The first one.
How do I know that we in the United States don't recognize as a human right the right to health?
To health, did you say?
To health.
Because we have to pay for our health.
Because we have to pay for it. And not only do we have to pay for it, but even when we allocate funds to it, it goes through our industrial system, our work system. You get health benefits if you work. And what happens when you stop working? You lose your health benefits. Well, then do you get them in the United States because you're a human being or because you are a worker? And women have known that their health benefits have been very different up until very, very recently. And then a lot of struggle. And children have to belong to a family. And when in the United States things get very tight and there isn't enough money to go around, what do we reduce first?
It's the human services.
Human services. The right health, education, and welfare funding. And we think it's perfectly normal. We continue to subsidize agriculture and industry, like Boeing, different companies, and expend for military materials long after we reduce health, education, and welfare. But it seems perfectly normal to us for some reason. Now, what I'm arguing that the agenda for the 80s is a women's agenda. It's not normal for women to put health, education, and welfare in second place to industrial development and to production, especially if enough is being produced. So we couldn't afford the women's agenda before the 1980s. Now we can't afford not to put it in first place. But let's put it in first place and see what happens. So we say, we're going to collect enough taxes to take care of the health, education, and welfare benefits needed for all the unemployed. Because everyone has a right to health, education, and welfare, whether they're employed or not. Then after we get finished using the tax money for that, that would mean that from elementary school up through graduate school, we would have free education. That would mean that all our new hospital plans and all our private hospitals, instead of doing what they're doing now, our private hospitals, that is putting in another corporate level, which is to make the hospital into a profit-making system, to make it productive. Instead of doing that, we would be taking that off of all of our hospitals and we would be funding them publicly. All our doctors and nurses then would be on the public payroll. All our teachers would be too. Everyone would have Social Security, not according to how many years they worked, but according to how much they needed. We wouldn't be able to stash away what we had as a private fund so that we could get more Social Security, when in fact we didn't need it because we had this stashed away. We wouldn't have to spend everything we had stashed away before we had sufficient any kind of public benefit. We wouldn't have to prove that we were indigent before we got public services. We would get it according to need, just the way the children in the family get it, unless they yell too loud. Now you say, well, we could never do that. Well, of course we can do it. Look. We produce enough, now for those of you that weren't here for those demonstrations, you have to look at the data. We produce enough food to feed the world. That red and pink map over there, except for the white, which is water, tells you where the overfed and the underfed people are. All the red part are overfed. All the pink part is underfed. This map here tells you where more production, high production is, the green part, where moderate production is and where low production is. So that we see that Asia, Africa, and then Latin America are the areas that need production development. Therefore, they need machinery and they need, they need machinery that goes with the kind of land they have to produce because they have very rich land. This map here tells you that we have an enormous, the number of people we have per square kilometer of arable land. It tells you where we're people have more land than they need for production, it's the second last column, and where people don't have enough land that they need for production. I'll put this one over here so you can look at it in your spare time. And this one, in the second last column, tells you where the quality of life is high and where the quality of life is low. The quality of life means high, low infant mortality, high life expectancy, and a high literacy rate, being able to use something to produce. Putting those three together is one measure. The physical quality of life for the world is 65. But for the first world countries, it's all over 90. The second world countries, it's around 80. And the third world countries, it goes as low as 40. Now, we learned the other night that people can learn to read and write anywhere from 6 weeks to 6 months. When at the same time that they're learning to read and write, they're learning how to take control of the political, economic, and social conditions of their life and take action to change those conditions. So what we're saying is we're living in a world where the resources are there. Just think of them in a store. They're all there. The people who need them are all here. To get to the store, you have to go through this finance system. This finance system is very productive for some people and totally unproductive for others. That's the problem, this system. So what we need is not, we don't need new ways of producing. We've got the technology, the men have provided us with that. The science is there, it's grounded. We know how to make durable goods. Oh, and another one of the pathologies is, we've known since 1963 how to produce durable goods, like durable stockings that don't wear out. I had a pair in 1960. I wore them for 8 months, and finally I threw them away because I was bored with them. But not because they wore out. They would look just like everybody else. Where are those stockings today? Why can't you buy them if they were invented before 1963?
No profit.
There's no profit. Because by now, everyone would have a pair, and we wouldn't need a second pair. But we would have invented a way of borrowing each other's stockings so that we could have the different colors. All we all need, except on the different sides, is one pair of feet. We could do that with our wardrobes. We could make dresses, suits, all kinds of things that don't wear out. But we would have to invent a way to have variety. We invented TV sets that wouldn't wear out. We could have one in every home and every village in the whole world. We could all talk to each other at this point. We could have international communication. We have a telecommunication system all invented where the whole world could speak through the system. And what we're doing now in a very powerful action that's going on between the multinationals and the United States government is trying to get several mixes of telecommunication so they'll be competitive on the market and so we can speak to each other. Those of us who use computers know very well that we're inventing ways of having several different languages, computer languages, instead of one. If we had one, we could teach it to our children. In 5 years, every child in the world could learn how to run a computer. They could take part in this quick production of durable goods made out of durable materials, save the rest of the materials for the other things we needed, produce the food, clothing, and shelter we needed. This is a woman's agenda. But people will say, and I'm using the word people now instead of women, because women, you know, all women don't pick up a women's agenda. All men don't pick up a men's agenda. I just said it was women's agenda. I didn't say it is what women do. But people will say, that's foolish. It's utopian. But if it can't be utopian if the materials exist, it's something, though. What is it? Why do we keep doing things? Why did we invent the production of things that wear out better and better? You have to invent that. You know, it's not easy to plan.
There's tremendous pressure on your male chairman of boards to show a tremendous rate of growth and profitability per year. And if that drops below a certain point, your stockholders move from your company to your competitor. And so the male agenda is to make sure that you don't have just a normal profitability, but that it increases, you know, geometrically each year.
Okay, who gets that profit? We've been through this afternoon.
Well, mainly the wealthy, but the stockholders.
Well, the stockholders get it.
No, government gets 50% first.
All right, so government gets 50%, Bob, and the stockholders get the rest of it. What does government spend the major part of its profit on?
Armament.
But would we need armament if we were friends? I mean, do you realize how we have to generate a dislike between the Soviet Union and the United States? Because we keep being favored nation partners. That's what we are. In trade, we're trading partners. But we have to generate hate, the most amazing kinds of it, in order to convince each other that we're enemies, so that we can keep on producing armament. Do you realize that we produce armament because we never really resolved how to convert in the Second World War, which we moved into because of the Depression, into some kind of production for human need? Now, what I'm doing is calling this a women's agenda. What I'm really arguing is not that women can solve this problem, nor that men can solve it, but that women and men together could solve it, but only if they're partners. But if women and men are going to be partners in industry and in government and in banking and in education, they also have to be partners in the production and distribution of children.
May I add that women control the majority of the capital of the country.
Could you explain that for us? Could you explain that?
Men die quicker. They get it. They control it.
No, that doesn't follow as easily. That really isn't so. The poorest people of the world are men, are children, and women. The majority of the world's poor. Now, the United Nations in 1975 produced some very fine evidence of that. Many women hanging in their office. And I really forgot to bring that. There's one of these charts on the world's children and one on the world's women. So that is not true. And even though women live longer, because of the distribution of income, it's much harder for them. It is true if you had a holding company that had men and women in it, and you left the investment in the holding company, in the end, the investments with women would have them. That's true. Well, why do we keep doing it? So we have one thing, we've said one thing, but that's the way we've done it, for profit. Let's look at profit for a moment. Why do we produce for profit?
That's necessary in economics. Keynesian economics will not work, but Schumpeter's basic assumption was, in his economic system, profits are essential.
All right, so we have two economic system theories. These are theories.
Well,
Keynesian, and we have two economic theories, classical economics and Keynesian economics, that argue that profits are essential to industry. Do we have any economic theories that claim that profit is not essential to production and distribution?
Socialism.
But what is our attitude toward socialism? Do we see it as an evil or a good? Let's have a show of hands on this. How many define socialism as an evil?
Pretty dull.
That's different, as an evil.
People commit suicide a lot in socialistic countries.
Now let's think a moment. Think in terms of what you've said about socialism, what you read about socialism, what you teach to your children about socialism. And let's try again. How many think of it as evil?
I think it's very evil if you want to assume that what I was told in a very socialistic country, East Germany recently, it works. They say, we make it work. We're Germans. We can make it. We're very efficient. We're making it work. And I looked at it and...
didn't look too good for
you. Grim.
Now, how many have studied social science in university or college? Raise your hand. Any social science? All right, now in the university where you studied it, how many studied socialism with the same seriousness and acceptance that you studied capitalism? Raise your hand. One. All right, now I want us to look at this. Let's look at what we mean by a university that teaches the liberal arts. The idea of a liberal arts education is that you go to the university and you hear and study from the perspective of those who value whatever it is. And then you learn the skills of making critical judgments on use, on selection. Isn't that right? Like you study music, you study many different musics, and then you make your choice as to what music is more valuable or less valuable. But in the Western universities, you do not study socialism that way. We, for the most part, now the University of Massachusetts at Amherst has a very positive program that studies socialism and capitalism. But there are very, very few places to go where you could make a considered judgment without being labeled. Now, if you're labeled, suppose you say, I really like socialism. Notice I didn't ask you because I didn't want you to be incriminated. At the moment, I'm if you studied socialism and you felt it was superior to capitalism, what would people call you?
Communist.
Now, would you feel good about it?
No.
No. Because what is it there isn't about communism that makes us not feel good about it?
There's no freedom.
All right, there's no, we say, there's no freedom.
And there's no God.
And there's no God. And that's a very important factor for most people in the West. There's no God. It's atheistic. It's against God. All right, now I'm going to look back for a minute to see how it got to be against God. Now, this is communism I'm talking about now, not socialism. I'm just talking about communism. It's atheistic. About 1840, when Marx was in the university, he was subjected, as everyone else does, to Hegel's theories of history, because that was what the philosophy of the university was. And Hegel was dead at this time, but the young Hegelians were quite certain that what Hegel said at the end of his theory of history was true, and that is that in the next era, we would come to the perfect era, and in that perfect era, we would be a German society. Perfect German society. Most people don't realize that Hegel did say that. Then, but he said the French Revolution was okay. It was a good thing to do because that was the end of a society that was all worn out. Just as it was good that Roman society came to an end, that Greek society came to an end. Because the world spirit is always moving towards greater and greater freedom, which is involved, incorporated into the institutional structure of a society, and is inevitably moving towards freedom, because God is freedom in history. So that freedom comes by the movement of the system. It happens by God's will. Well, if it happens by God's will, said Marx, we'll have to sit around and wait until God sees fit to help the poor. Because in the industrial society of 1840, and by this time, he was moving into living in England because he was being put out of Germany, really, for saying these things. And he saw very, very poor people working 72 hours as the normal work week. And the law of in 1840 in England introduced a law that children would work 72 hours a week. And that was the compassionate law to keep them off the street while their parents were working. Parents, fathers and mothers, working in the factory. So the ideal of the mother working at home and the father working in the factory was only an option for the non-poor, not for the poor. And when he looked closer to see who was affirming this role, he heard the people being preached to this way. And some of you who know your Marx Weber will recognize it. To the very, very poor, the preaching went, be patient, don't rebel, endure this awful suffering. Yes, life is very hard, but wait, your reward will be heaven, and you will live blissfully there forever after. And he heard the preaching to the working class who were working those long hours and under those terrible conditions. Be thrifty, hard working, and initiating. And if you must live it up, do it on the weekend. But come regularly to work on Monday and work through to Saturday night and give a fair day's work for a fair day's wage. And God will bless your orderly life. And to the affluent, thank God that he has bestowed these blessings upon us. Surely this is a foretaste of heaven. And then to Bach music, to leave the sanctuary and beautiful church. What he argued was, those are not sermons. That's generating a false consciousness. It's preventing the revolution of the dispossessed because they're afraid they'll lose everything here and heaven also. It keeps the workers producing things that are not in their interest because they're not makers of the design or planners of the design. Or they're not producing the industry that could be used to develop the land and the industry in poor countries where you need simple machinery. But it's letting the non-poor, the wealthy, go home thinking that nothing that's happening in their life is in any way a cause of what's happening to the others. It takes them off the hook. Now, what I just preached, Marx did not say that. Max Weber, in 1918, teaching his course in sociology of religion at the university, and explaining to the class what he hears in the early 20th century in church, that he preached those sermons. He didn't preach them. He said, that's what I hear. And that's in his Sociology of Religion, chapters 4, 5, and 6. But he was always responding to Marx. What Marx said, that religion, as preached that way, is an opium for the people. What Marx was saying, if that's the way we deal with God, we have co-opted God into our production system to legitimate our doing it this way. Now that was 100 years ago. Marx also argued that those who had their grasp on the things that the poor needed would never withhold, would never release that grasp, never. That the only way the poor would ever get control of industry, the means of production, would be to take it forcibly away from those who have it. And that if they rely on God's help, they would be afraid to do it. They would become fearful before they did it. And so he chose to say what Feuerbach was saying, that God is just a figment of our imagination. Now that's where the atheism of Marx came. There were many Christian socialists at that time. The whole agrarian socialist movement was very Christian. It's just one form of communism that was atheistic, that form. We have to remember that, because to use the word Marxist for these other forms is first inaccurate. The Christian socialists of Chile, working against the Christian Democrats of Chile, were all religious people. And when Allende came into office in 1973, we helped to overthrow his duly elected government on the basis of the fact that it was Marxist. It was Christian socialist. Those of us who know the people who were working there, they were missionaries. Many of them were from your church and from my church. They were people that we knew.
Wasn't that merely the ideological reason that was given? I mean, in reality, wasn't it because they were nationalizing companies that we had very large vested interest in? Kennecott and Alaconda.
And that is the problem. Because we talk about our government and our industry as unrelated. Because if we were capitalists, there would be no incorporation of our government into industry, but our government subsidizes our industry. So we don't have a free enterprise system, and haven't had it for a long time. Well, now, what I have laid out for you to puzzle over is that this is the women's agenda, feeding, clothing, and sheltering. Since we have enough to produce without paying for it, we could take all the unemployed of the world and put them working where we need them, in special health care, in education, especially education for the handicapped, where you need one person for very few people, and it costs a lot to have those specialized professional workers. But all the unemployed could be doing the paramedical work, the teaching assistants, the social security, all the things that we're firing people for now. Now the only problem we have is how we're going to pay them. Now I leave you with that problem. Because that is a problem that's solvable. Because all we would have to do is to pay them out of our common wealth. What's our common wealth?
Okay.
our taxes. But if we reduce our taxes, we can't do it. We reduce our taxes so we'll be able to send our children to college, to get good health care, to have insurance. But if we had it anyway, we wouldn't need it. Now, I present that to you because that's the problem of the 80s. It's a mandate of the gospel. Our churches have affirmed it. We're calling our churches Marxists. This little document that I have here called Catholic Teaching Regarding Capitalism and Socialism is published by all places by the Justice and Peace Committee of Detroit, of the Diocese of Detroit. It's hardly Marxist. However, it's looked at them that way. So the problem is we have the facilities, we have the resources, we have enough people, we have people caring about health, education, and welfare, but we have a system that doesn't work.
How do you make these people get out and work then?
We have no problems with it. You take the migrant workers. The migrant workers are the hottest workers in the United States.
They are, yeah. They're inspired by something. They want money.
No, but see, they won't need it.
Okay, then they won't work.
Look, I don't get any income. I work.
Well, maybe you enjoy it.
Well, maybe they will too. That's what people
That was Marx's whole point. It was the alienation of the individual from what he or she produced that caused the problem, and this whole program is one to reunite the individual with the product that that individual produces. And I don't have a boring day at my job either because I love what I produce. And that is a model, I think, here, and we shouldn't just cave into what we define reality, since that reality is a fallen system. There is another way. I think you women should get together between today and tomorrow and write the agenda clearly for us, because you can see the problem.
Together.
It's written across our personal lives. We men neglect our families, our children, things that are good for us, our bodies, and all the rest. For what?
You
for this money,
money,
this almighty dollar. What's that?
You don't do the dishes very well either.
I'll bring my cup over here.